Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's just 4 minutes after the hour, so if you're getting your day just started, like I assume you are, welcome. Nice to have you here, and hope you had a good night's sleep, and as you're rubbing the sand out of your eyes, I hope you got a nice cup of coffee planned, or however you get your day started. I'm glad you got the radio on. Matthew chapter 6, verse 34 says, "So don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will bring its own worries. Today's trouble is enough for today." So if you actually prayed that prayer yesterday, don't worry about tomorrow, then today is the day that you're not worrying about. Isn't that nice? Just so convenient. I helped you figure that out. Anyway, glad you're with me this morning. I saw that Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is doing another movie, and Rambo is going to do Rambo 5. I know his first movie was entitled, subtitled First Blood. That was the first Rambo movie. Rambo 5 is subtitled, oh no, is that blood? Call the doctor. Anyway, we've got a great show. Ben Johnson's with us from the Acton Institute, and it is the 200th anniversary of Karl Marx's birthday or something. We're going to talk to him about the impact Karl Marx has had. And then Dr. Kent Kaiser is going to be in studio in the first hour. And then Bill English will be with us in hour two, and Karen Swallow Pryor, professor of English at Liberty University, is going to be with us in the second hour. So it's going to be really a great, great show. So keep your radio tuned on and turned up, and we'll take a little short break and be back in just a minute with Ben Johnson. Let's get the big show going here at 7 minutes after the hour. I have on our studio line the senior editor of the Acton Institute, Ben Johnson, a favorite of mine. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Bill. Good to be with you.
Thank you so much. We're on the 200th anniversary of Karl Marx's birth. Let's talk about the impact he's had on the world.
I suspect you probably didn't buy a cake.
I did not. You got that? I didn't even order one. Sometimes I order it and don't pick it up. But anyway, I didn't even order one.
Yeah, of course, Karl Marx, everyone, just in case the name has, I realize the name is no longer taught in public schools, was the father of communism, the mm-hmm. father of Marxism, and because of his ideology, which was proclaimed in the Communist Manifesto, which he co-wrote with Friedrich Engels in the 1840s, we've had communism in the world, of course, best known being practiced currently in North Korea and Cuba, but historically in the Soviet Union from 1917 to 1991. Celebrated would be the wrong word, but we just marked and commemorated the 100th anniversary of the Communist Revolution in Moscow last November. And during the time that communism was at its apex during the 100 years that from 1917 forward, 100 million people died as a result of that, not to mention wow. persecution of the church, not to mention persecution of all religious faiths within the domain over which it exercised control, and the denial of human rights, the denial that people had any inherent human dignity. So Karl Marx is responsible for the repression of hundreds of millions of people throughout human history because of an ideology that he came up with, which is extraordinarily materialist and dehumanizing in every single respect.
So, yet...
Other than that, he was a marvelous guy.
Yeah. I'm thinking of trying to find the one reason in my head that he still remains to have any kind of popularity, because he still does. He still remains quite popular.
He does, particularly on university campuses and intelligentsia, people who have control of the op-ed pages in the New York Times and the mm-hmm. Washington Post. So on his the 200th anniversary of his birthday, during that week, the New York Times ran a piece saying, happy 200th birthday, Karl Marx. You were right. And of course, there was another one in the Washington Post not that long ago, which I had overlooked, but which some people at Faith Radio had pointed out to me, called "It's Time to Give Socialism a Try." So we've been down this road actually before. We don't mm-hmm. we don't need to try it over and over again. But yeah, Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto propounded a view of history that people are actually controlled by the group that they're born into. So if you happen to be born into a social class that's well off, there's really nothing that you can do to change things because of the way that you've grown up. Your social class is shaped the way that you see the world. You can't be changed. You can't really be rehabilitated. The only people who get to go to rehabilitation are people who were born into a revolutionary social class but don't support the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else has to be liquidated. And this was applied with unbelievable execution, if you'll forgive the pun, throughout the history of communism.
Mm-hmm. Ben, people want to still follow this theory, yet despite what they know will be, or what they will discover will be damaging results, why do they want to continue to follow this political theory?
Well, it's always presented as a beautiful theory. And it's quite alluring in the sort of cliff notes way that it's presented, which is that everyone will be equal under this system. And we're told constantly that equality is the most important thing, but we don't usually define the term. When equality is discussed by people of faith, for example, the Bible says, don't be a respecter of persons, be sure to mete out equal justice to the rich and the poor alike. What we're talking about is equality before God. We believe in equality before the law. We believe that we should all be held to the same moral standards as anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Jesus Christ didn't come for any one group, either ethnically or economically or anything else. Jesus Christ came to redeem the entire world. That's the message we proclaim. So there's equality in that spiritual sense. What Karl Marx was talking about was equality of result, where everyone supposedly will have the same amount of economic resources. So instead of someone who's competent, starting up a business, running his own business, and maybe employing people to work for him, everyone through the state will own an equal share of that business.
Mm-hmm.
And then the state will decide what is done with it. That's the theory known as socialism. So
mm-hmm.
rather than private enterprise and entrepreneurship, everyone will own a little bit of that. And Karl Marx believed that you would form this massive mammoth state. And once all of the goods and resources of that entire nation were redistributed, then there would be peace on earth and the state itself would disappear. And there would be nothing but harmony among the workers who are equally sharing their resources. That's incredibly attractive to think about until you drill down into what he was really saying. Part of it is that he believed in a complete and universal worldwide revolution that had to be carried out by violent means. In his writings in 1849, 1848, and 1850, he personally endorsed what he called, quote, revolutionary terror. And in one of his writings, he talks about how we will have no compassion, and we ask no compassion from you. When our time comes, we will make no excuses for the terror. So he in one of his other writings, he talks about how hatred has to be continued and whipped up and directed by the communists until people are continually carrying out violent acts against what is known as the bourgeoisie, the upper class, or the rich, until the end of the revolution. So he's talking about violence. He's completely atheistic. Matter of fact, the one area where he always had a difference with his fellow socialists was that some of the socialists would talk about the immorality of capitalism. And he'd say, guys, what are you talking about? There's no such thing as morality because there's no such thing as God. So when you come to that extreme of position, that's how you can believe that whole classes of people, regardless of whether they're good people, bad people, regardless of their actual actions, need to be liquidated in search of your revolutionary dream.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how socialism would ever work, Ben, because people can't even get along in their condominium associations.
Right. Socialism has never worked. Economically speaking, it has always turned nations into basket cases. And, of course, the foremost practitioner of socialism today is North Korea. And we know the economic conditions in North Korea from people who have run away from there. They talk about how people in North Korea eat what's known as field soup, which is to say they you know, go out into the fields and eat dirt and dust and sticks, which they mix together with water because it's the only food that they can get. Socialism doesn't work. It can't work. The fact of the matter is, if you don't give anyone any economic incentive to work, which is to say you reward those who work better than others and you don't pay those who refuse to work, then what incentive does anyone have to do anything more than the most perfunctory job possible? Slaves don't have any incentive to work, so that's why it was an incredibly inefficient system. Economically speaking, it didn't produce very well. And you can't expect slaves to be good workers. So that's essentially what slavery does, is reduce us all to the system where we have no incentive to do anything above and beyond the absolute minimum. And that's what happened throughout the Soviet Union. It always, throughout socialist history, ended up with people not producing enough. The shelves were bare. And people, if they needed any kind of material or goods, had to buy them on the black market.
Marx predicted that capitalism would lead to poverty in the midst of plenty. And I was just reading that there, you know, I don't know what you think about that, but he's the housing and urban development estimates say that there's 500,000 homeless people in the United States on any given night in a country that is estimated to have roughly 18 million empty homes in it.
There's no question that there's still persistent poverty. Jesus talked about this. He said, "The poor you will have with you always." Mm-hmm. So there's no question that there is poverty. A lot of it is related to mental illness and deinstitutionalization, which took place in the 1980s, so that people who previously had had a home in an institution were released.
Right.
And unfortunately, they simply don't. Addiction is also a major part of it. What we should look at, though, is the level of well-being. When we talk about poverty in the United States versus extreme poverty, they're not comparable phenomena. Poverty in the United States is nothing like poverty in extreme countries like North Korea.
That's true.
Even the homeless have access to a tremendous number of calories. They have access to food.
Right.
Most of them have access to a homeless shelter. Just being around, study after study has proven, just being in a country that has prosperity means that the poor have greater access to the needs of life, all of the necessities, than being among the elite in more, quote-unquote, equal societies.
Mm-hmm.
When this, there was a statue that was unveiled to Karl Marx in his hometown of Trier, Germany, on the 200th anniversary of his birth on May 8th. And the leader of the EU is there to unveil this 14-foot-tall statue donated by China to the hometown of Karl Marx. And the premier of China, probably for life from now on, Xi Jinping, had made a statement that day that Karl Marx was the greatest thinker in the history of mankind. And he said he donated that statue to prove the scientific proof, the scientific validity of Marxism. The fact of the matter is, when China was trying its best to be a Marxist country, extreme poverty, people living under $2 a day, made up 88% of the people of China. Today, it's about 6.5%.
Wow.
So that extreme poverty, as China has moved away from the theories of Karl Marx. So there are undoubtedly persistent pockets of poverty in the United States and throughout the capitalist West. I'm going to go out on a limb here and predict that Jesus was right, and we will always have those.
Indeed.
On the other hand, we do our best to provide for those people, and in communist societies or socialist societies, they lack the resources to do anything in order to help the poor. Mm-hmm. They create more of them.
Ben, I learned so much when you're on the show. Let me take a little break. When I come back, I want to continue this conversation with Ben Johnson, senior editor of the Acton Institute. We'll be right back. Thanks for being with me this morning. It's 21 minutes after the hour, and now 22 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Ben Johnson, senior editor of the Acton Institute. We're talking a little bit about Karl Marx and his birthday, the 200th birthday this week, and how the world still sort of cheers his work, which we cannot believe. We're scratching our heads. I found this interesting, Ben. There's a new board game that kind of is kind of the opposite of Monopoly, kind of talks about what socialism's all about. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, I wrote a blog about that this past week for Acton.org's blog, the Power Blog, about a game called Socialism the Game. And one of the closest glimpses to eternal perdition is what parents have to go through when children discover the game Monopoly. That game goes on forever, doesn't it?
Am I wrong? Is oh, it no, just it does. It does.
It's longer than actual childhood, I think. but the game was actually invented by a lady in who wanted to demonstrate how terrible capitalism was. And her idea was you would have your job would be to go out and gobble up all of the property, and eventually everyone except you would be in poverty, and you would realize how terrible capitalism is and how we had to change the system. Now, capitalism doesn't actually work like the game in real life, but that's a totally different situation. Some of the there were some young people who had seen this and decided they wanted to come up with a game that illustrated how socialism worked. So it's what's called an unofficial expansion pack. So you get, instead of community chess, you get communist chess cards. Mm. Instead of chance, they're called fat chance cards. It comes in a box, and the instead of the man with a mustache and all the rest of it, Uncle Punnybags, you get people who look an awful lot like Bernie Sanders on the cards. And the idea is that instead of a bank, each time around the federal government redistributes money to you and then takes half of it back and gives it to other people. And as the game goes on, whenever you purchase a property at various stages, the government repossesses all of the property that you have and puts public housing on it. And this goes on until everyone has nothing except $300 left or less. And once everyone is equally poor, then the game is over. So it's really, very, very humorous illustration. And a lot of the cards are just hilarious. So you have these funny little unforeseen things where there's a windless cloudy day, so there's no energy, and you have to pay money for a black market generator, things like that.
Uh-huh.
So very, very funny game. But a man at Vox.com, which is sort of one of these lifestyle left wing websites, they sort of revel in how they hate the Christian worldview.
Uh-huh.
Vox.com got four democratic socialists together to play the game. They're members of the Democratic Socialists of America. I was hoping they'd get Bernie Sanders and Keith Ellison and Jen Schakowsky and some of the representatives from U.S. Congress who have either belonged to or have spoken at Democratic Socialists of America events. Bernie Sanders is very upfront about the fact that he's a Democratic Socialist.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than that, they got a couple of rank and file members of TSA, and they loved the game. It talks about how they really enjoyed playing it, and every so often they would see a rule and they'd say, "We wish we had this in real life." And as it was going on, instead of going to jail, you get sent to what's called rehabilitation. So one of the members shouted out as one person. Continually, and apparently the more doubles that you roll, the more you go to rehabilitation sort of to punish success.
Yeah.
So as one of the players was doing this, he said that one of the people there went on and on. That's right. We're sending you to rehabilitation. We're keeping you on the straight and narrow. This would be wonderful in real life. So what you find out is that all of the socialist caricatures, so-called, everything that conservatives have said and people who believe in liberty have said about socialism and socialists and their view of the world is 100% correct. They really do want everyone to be equally poor. They really are motivated by envy, and they really do like it when people get sent to rehabilitation. They believe they're doing it for their own good, and that is their view of the world. And if you read the article, they're incredibly upfront about the fact that they like the game. they think it's an accurate representation of their views, and they would like to bring it about in reality around the world.
Mm. Unbelievable. You know, Ben, I put you on my speed dialer, just so you know.
Well, that's very kind of you. I wish you had more friends.
I know, me too.
more interesting friends.
I know. Thank you so much for doing the show. I look forward to our next conversation.
Likewise, as always, Bill.
Thanks a lot. My guest has been...
Thank you, and God bless.
Yep. My guest has been Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. It is half past the hour. That piano music is Billy Joel, who is celebrating his 69th birthday today. I was going to try to play a familiar Billy Joel song, but he just didn't have many hits, so I couldn't find one. Anyway, we'll take a short break. When we come back, Ken Kaiser's in studio.
Would you be willing to do a values audit on your home? If you are, it could make a difference for the next generation. This is Jim Garlow in a special series for the family. To what extent are you conveying biblical values in your home? I call it osmotic learning. By osmosis, I mean the atmosphere in your home. What are you permitting in your home? What are you directing in your home? What are the things that are special? How are you creating special memories or traditions? It doesn't matter if you don't have children, you may be an uncle or an aunt. You have an impact on some kids somewhere. And conversely, what are you doing to proactively shield your children or your grandchildren from influences that are destroying their souls? Let me remind you, this is a big deal to God. This is Jim Garlow. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. You know, that music belongs to Kent Kaiser, his walk-up music. He is in studio. Dr. Kent Kaiser is communications chair here at the University of Northwestern and a regular guest I always look forward to. Good morning, Kent.
Good morning.
So you went to Candace Owens' speech yesterday, biggest turnout they've ever had for a lunch speech through this organization. Do tell.
Right. The think tank, Center of the American Experiment, puts on these luncheons and sometimes breakfast or dinner, and in this case, it was the largest luncheon crowd they have ever had for a speaker. It was 550 people there at the Marriott in downtown Minneapolis.
What'd they serve?
Oh, it was some kind of salad or something. Okay. But you know, they were serving up good messages. But it was really interesting to see because of the collection of people who were there. Oftentimes, these kinds of it's like a lecture, and oftentimes when you go to these kinds of events, it's a lot of older donor type people, but this crowd was full of young people. It was great. There were everybody from high school up to retirees.
Really?
There. Yeah, so lots of high school students. In fact, donors pay for students to go to Center of the American Experiment events, and so they get to go for free. And so there were dozens and dozens of students there, and I saw some college students there I knew, and mm-hmm. you know, and then lots of people who are political activists, and you know, and they put these in downtown. They hold these in downtown Minneapolis oftentimes around lunchtime, so that'll attract the business crowd too. So you had the business people there. So it was a really great collection of people there to hear Candace Owens speak.
Tell our listeners who she is.
Well, she's I don't even know how old she is. She's young.
28.
Okay, so she's a young activist, and she's African American, and she is conservative. And she'll say that it would have been easier for her to come out to her family as lesbian than it was for her to come out to her family as being a conservative. So she's a conservative and really about a lot of different issues. And she started out listening to liberals on television, and she just got so fed up with what she was seeing that she had this great job in the world of finance. She gave that up ultimately to do what she does now, which is to go around the country and speak on conservative topics and to get people motivated to be conservative activist. But she got so fed up with what she was hearing that she decided that she just had to do something about it. So she sat there on her couch or whatever and made like a 4-minute YouTube video and put that out there online, saying why, you know, she was a conservative or what, why the liberal view was wrong. And it got, within a half hour, it got tens and thousands of views and ultimately millions of views. And it just took off like wildfire. Well, so that's what she does now. She started out doing these YouTube videos, and she's, her idea, she was saying yesterday, is that while there are many black conservatives who have come before her, and oftentimes they will deliver lectures or write books and things, and they might be more intelligent, she'll even say, what she does is she takes their ideas and or ideas of others, and she doesn't claim to have a monopoly on ideas for sure, but she takes the ideas, distills them down into something that a new generation can digest, and which is like 4-minute videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
And so she gets the conservative philosophy out there, and it was kind of, it was so much fun because she recently became particularly famous when Kanye West tweeted that he liked her ideas. Mm-hmm. He just tweeted, "I like the way Candace Owens thinks."
Mm-hmm.
And wow, the liberal media have just attacked Kanye West for that particular tweet, because he's basically left the fold. You know, if you're an African American in America today, particularly part of African American like pop culture, like Kanye West is as a rapper, then you are supposed to toe the line when it comes to liberal politics, or you're not supposed to get involved at all. Well, he stepped in it, and so in the liberal media are really attacking him for it. But it's interesting to see, because now we've seen an actual shift and in how African Americans are starting to think about things like President Trump. I mean, mm-hmm. Kanye West has said some nice things about President Trump recently, saying that he's his friend and so on. And we've seen the support among African American males increase from 11% to 22% for President Trump. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot, but that could be a difference in an election. And what's more interesting, I think, is that there used to be about 1.5% of African Americans who say that they weren't sure about President Trump. Well, now that's 7.5%. So that means that those are people who are maybe willing to consider a President Trump for re-election or something. And I don't know if it extends beyond President Trump. I mean, I think that many times we might overstate, like, ooh, now all kinds of conservative people are going to become conservatives or vote conservative. And I don't know that that's the case, but maybe for President Trump. And that was one point that Candace Owens made too yesterday, is that most black people are conservatives and just don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're conservatives and they've been raised to believe they need to be a Democrat just for identity politics purposes. But she said that where she came from, she was conservative. Everybody's a conservative, but, you know, they get sort of lured into the idea that they need to be part of these government programs and that the Democrats are going to take care of black people.
Right. Now, she used to be a liberal or used to be a Democrat. And did she talk about having an aha moment, or was there a truth bomb that came into her life that sort of she turned on?
It seemed like that was what she was talking about when she was, you know, watching liberal media. And then all of a sudden, you know, she decided she needed to do this YouTube video that took off. And it's interesting because she had a successful career. I'm sure she was extremely well paid, and she left all that in order to go and work for now Turning Point, which is, you know, really a fledgling organization. I mean, it's taken off like wildfire, but it's not like she's probably getting paid, you know, huge money to do that.
Right. So I guess what I appreciate about Candace is she doesn't tell you what to think. She just tells you to think.
Right. And it was very interesting to see this crowd yesterday, too, and asking questions. There were a number of older African-American activists there, which is also not the most common thing to see at a Center of the American Experiment event. Usually the crowd is pretty white. But there are a couple of especially older ladies who stood up, and, you know, they had been conservative activists since back in the 60s, they were there, and they stood up and they were just saying, oh, we've been praying for you, somebody like you, to come along for decades, and you know, practically tears in their eyes and things. One woman talking about how she had volunteered for President Nixon, and for his election, and had been a volunteer for all these years, and how she'd been threatened by the Democrats, and how, you know, because of her views. And finally, here she has somebody like Candace Owens, who's young and getting more people on board with the conservative message. And again, you know, I think we can't. It's easy to overstate, you know, the importance of like Candace Owens and Kanye West and that. But there might be something. And Candace Owens was talking about that yesterday too, about how she thinks in the upcoming months we're going to see more of a shift. Now, I don't know if that means that she thinks that there's more famous black conservatives who are going to come out, or what. But she thinks that there's more to it than just this little flash in the pan.
Yeah. Now, Ken, she's very entertaining in her edited 4-minute videos. Did it translate into a live presentation?
Yeah, maybe not as much.
Yeah.
Yeah, her videos are pretty animated. In this case, it's a more formal setting when you're speaking to a crowd of 550
right.
people.
Yeah.
And she had to be, you have to speak slower and everything because of the, you know, the microphone and all. But it was still fun.
Yeah. Let me take a break. When I come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Ken Kaiser. I'm going to ask him about the President Trump withdrawing from the U.S. from the Iran deal and see what his take is on that. We'll be back in just a little bit. It's 15 minutes till the top of the hour. The big hand is on the 47, so I'll do the math for you. That gives you 13 minutes till the top of the hour. I have in studio Dr. Kent Kaiser, Chair of Communications here at the University of Northwestern. And Kent, the Senate primaries, did the Republicans avoid their worst-case fears?
It seems that way. We had some primaries yesterday in three states, West Virginia, Indiana, and Ohio. And listeners might recall in the past, sometimes Republicans have put up candidates who have gotten candidates through the primary who were ultimately unelectable in the general election. And particularly the one that was most interesting yesterday was in West Virginia, because for a long time there was one candidate who was pretty controversial, had actually spent some time in prison because of his role in a coal mine disaster where people died. He went to prison, and then he was the front-running candidate for some time. And then the Republican National Committee spent some money against that person. And President Trump, more importantly, President Trump tweeted and spoke out against that particular candidate. And thankfully, that particular candidate did not win the Republican primary. And they now have a candidate who could very well beat the Democratic incumbent. West Virginia is a very interesting state politically because I can even remember, even in the 1980s, it was always a Democratic state. It was reliably Democratic, and until Ronald Reagan's second term, and then it went Republican. And since then, it's become more and more Republican. However, they currently have a Democratic U.S. Senator in Joe Manchin, and he's sort of a conservative Democrat, to be sure, but he is a Democrat.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to certain important votes like leadership and so on in the Senate, he, of course, votes with Democrats. And so he's a pretty vulnerable candidate at this point, or a vulnerable U.S. senator, because West Virginia has changed so much. Today, if you were looking at a map of states and thinking, like, what are the most conservative states? West Virginia is certainly up there as one of the most conservative. And so I think Republicans view this now as one of the possible places where they could beat an incumbent Democrat. And it's the same thing in Indiana. They came through with a pretty decent candidate who, you know, some of the other candidates were maybe a little bit more too conservative, even for Indiana, which is a really conservative state. But they currently have a Democratic U.S. senator there, too, who now might be vulnerable. And same thing in Ohio. And I think that the Ohio U.S. senator, Sherrod Brown, who's another Democrat, I think he's probably a little safer because he's fairly popular. But the Republicans are being pragmatic, I think, in their choices here through these primaries. We'll see how it goes through the rest of the summer. There are many, many primaries that take place all the way into August. And so we'll see who Republicans put up in the other states. But the Republicans are really looking at trying to hold the U.S. Senate, and they're probably going to you could lose some seats here and there, so they need to make up for that in some other places in order to maintain the majority in the U.S. Senate. And for listeners, probably the most important aspect of the U.S. Senate is that they confirm the court appointments, mm-hmm. and especially U.S. Supreme Court appointments. And so you wouldn't want to have President Trump having to try and get a nominee through a Democratic U.S. Senate, because especially after the, let's just say the games that were played in the last president with President Obama's last pick, not even getting a hearing, I think that a Democratic U.S. Senate would maybe want to just hold out through an entire Trump term without seating a new U.S. senator or a U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Mm-hmm. So that's what the real issue is. So it's very important for Republicans and for President Trump, particularly, to have a U.S. Senate mm-hmm. that is Republican.
All right, Kent, you're a professor, and I'm a solid B student, okay, C student. And there is discussion now about President Trump pulling out of this Iran deal. And so in the Iranian parliament yesterday, they've got a flag of the U.S., and they're burning it, chanting death to America. I don't know. Is this such a bad deal that we want to not allow Iran to have nuclear weapons?
Well, we did pull out. President Trump did decide to pull out of this deal, much to the chagrin of European allies. Mm-hmm. It was a bad deal. And President Trump campaigned on this. And lo and behold, he's made good on another campaign promise.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the thing that's driving liberals crazy. Like, he had these campaign promises, and one by one by one by one, he is
keeping
these promises. It's just unheard of in Washington.
Yeah, how dare you do that?
But no, I think this was. I mean, I trust the president on this particular issue. I think that he was praised from Israel, which is. Let's think about this. Okay, so you've got the Middle East, and you've got Israel, and you've got Iran, and Iran is saying, "Oh, you know, this is terrible. It's terrible," and Israel is saying, "Thank you, President Trump." Okay, I'm on Israel's side. So mm-hmm. if Israel says it's good, then it's good to get out of this nuclear deal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how people trust Iran. They say they've sent in, people to make sure that they're upholding their end of the deal and so on. How could they even know? I don't know how one can trust a country like Iran after they've done so many untrustworthy things over the years.
Is it a money deal, Kent, or do they really want nuclear weapons?
Well, okay, so yeah, there's two things there. They're trying to develop nuclear weapons, and now you know that the deal's off, they'll probably try and ramp that up again, and so then we'll have to do something to prevent that. But yes, this is all about money. This is all about oil money, particularly for the Europeans. The Europeans don't have much oil. We do. In the United States, we could be self-sufficient with oil. Europeans could not. And so the Europeans just, definitely want to have a trade with Iran, and will probably continue to do so even as we reimpose the sanctions that we had under previous presidents, including Obama, until Obama decided to come up with this deal. I think this was something that Obama wanted. He was at the end of his presidency, he wanted to be able to show he had done something. And so he did a couple of these things.
This was an executive order thing, wasn't it?
At the last minute, these kinds of things were he had a number of these things, but this is on an international stage, this is probably the biggest thing. And so this is like his signature. This is why the liberals are so going apoplectic over it, is that this was Obama's thing. And so here we have Trump dismantling it and leaving nothing of the Obama legacy in terms of foreign policy. But just think back to the Obama administration and how ineffective they were on the international stage, and how little was accomplished. We just muddled along for those 8 years, mm-hmm. honestly. I mean, people say it would seem to be a sort of a listless, like there was no compass for this foreign policy. It was just, there was a red line here, and then Syria would cross it, and then we didn't do anything. And all over the world, we were just weak. We mm-hmm. were quote unquote leading from behind, according to Obama. And that was not a formula for success internationally. I think President Trump is turning that around, and I think people should be very happy that he has turned that around and made the United States, you know, a leader again. Now, people abroad might not like it. I mean, but honestly, you know, you got to look at the motivations of the Europeans and others who are now criticizing President Trump for getting out of the Iran deal. I always say follow the money. And with the Europeans, it's definitely a deal of following the money, and it'll lead right up to the oil tankers that are coming from Iran to Europe.
Mm-hmm. What was the original Iran deal? I mean, didn't the U.S. give Iran $150
billion? Oh, yeah. We gave them all kinds of cash.
I know,
literally
cash. On a plane, yeah. On a pallet.
Yes.
On a plane. What was that for?
You couldn't, you know, if you wrote a movie script like this,
No one would buy it.
Nobody would buy it.
It's too unbelievable.
It's not believable.
I couldn't agree more.
And yet it happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, that was the deal. And I think years down the line, probably people will look back and say that President Trump did the right thing. But right now, it's getting a lot of criticism in the liberal media because, again, this was Obama's signature international accomplishment. I guess you might call it an accomplishment. I don't know if it's accomplishment.
Now going away.
Right.
Yeah. Kent, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having
me on.
Always
good to see you. Yeah. And good luck on your last week of school and then finals and all of that grading papers.
Yeah.
A lot of work.
Looking forward to it.
Good deal. Thanks so much, Kent. It's 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be right back. Good morning. It's 2 minutes till the top of the hour. I was stretching and yawning. Rebecca said, you got to get back on the air. I go, oh, okay. Better. We got a great second hour coming up. Bill English is in the green room. We're going to talk about solitude. You know how we get bombarded with interruptions every day. We get email alerts, telephone, coworkers, and sometimes you just can't get your work done because of all the interruptions. We're going to talk about how we can build solitude into our workday because solitude's important. Stay focused. And I hope you're getting some solitude this morning with your Lord and Savior, Jesus. We'll take a little break. Hour two is up next. Thanks for being with me. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.